I Feel the Earth Move. And talking about Earth, I tell you what, we've had lots of tracks on in this part of the show that are all related, really, to what we're about to talk about right now, because on the line I've got Dr. David Whitehouse. And Dr. David Whitehouse is an author of multiple books, including The Moon and the Sun, and his latest book as well, Apollo 11, The Inside Story. Good afternoon to you, Dr. David.
Good afternoon, Billy. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Great to talk to you again, and thanks very much, as always, for your time this afternoon. Now, I'm sure, David, that a lot of listeners at home will be sat here thinking, well, you know, what's going on? Well, it is, of course, the 50th anniversary, isn't it, to this day? Well, a day and a bit now, actually, that Apollo 11 launched into the sky.
That's right. The 50th anniversary was yesterday of the launch, and on Saturday, it's the anniversary of the landing, and in the early hours of Sunday morning, it'll be the anniversary of the first footprint on another world.
It's incredible. And of course, since then, we've seen so much development in terms of what we're able to do and where we're able to go. I mean, of course, I know you've written a book on the Sun as well, but of course, Mars is now something that people are talking about. Eventually, maybe humans will be able to go there. But talking about Apollo 11, Dr. David, I do want to ask you, because I like to ask questions that our listeners at home would probably like to ask if they were speaking to you. And one of those would be, you often hear this myth or this sort of, I suppose you could call it an old wives' tale in a way, because it's not exactly anything that's been verified. And I want to get it verified from you, because you hear this do the rounds every now and again about Apollo 11 being 100 times less, 100,000 times less powerful than a smartphone. You hear that do the rounds every now and again. I mean, is that actually true? I mean, was Apollo 11 really that basic?
In terms of power, the Apollo computers on board were very simple. They were state-of-the-art at the time, and they were specifically designed to do the job that they had to do. They weren't general-purpose computers that had been programmed to land on the moon. They were designed almost with the program already stored inside them. But they were backed up by a whole floor of very large computers, very large mainframes, the type of which we don't get very often these days, and a whole floor back at Mission Control in Houston. So although they were not like a modern smartphone, they were state-of-the-art computers at the time. And although they didn't multitask like smartphones do, they were quite powerful at producing very accurate calculations to back up the crew, and the crew relied on the computer to help them land. So they were sophisticated machines with small amounts of memory. I think it was 128K, which is tiny, tiny, tiny compared to smartphones.
But yes.
Had backup. And it worked because it was designed with only that one job in mind.
Yeah, and of course, I think that's what a lot of people forget, because it only had the programming, the function of the, I suppose you could say, the electronics on Apollo 11, because they all each had their own purpose. Obviously, a smartphone nowadays, you can do so many things on it. You can listen to the radio, make telephone calls, text people, even do what we're doing now, which is having a chat, you know, live right now. And of course, technology has advanced so much more since then. So I suppose what you're saying is that the reason why it was able to happen, the reason why Apollo 11 and the mission was so successful, is because each of the, despite the technology not being as advanced as it is today, each bit of technology was very specific and had very specific uses. Is that right?
That's right. For instance, carry on about the Apollo landing computer. It was designed to what's now become a military standard, in the sense that if it froze, if it had a glitch, it started up again, but it carried on from where it froze. You didn't have to reboot it and then go through the program again to get to the point you were at. So it could cope with emergencies, it could cope with power outages, and it was a very sophisticated computer for its time, and it set the standard for military computers in airplanes and in other spacecraft in the decades to come.
Interesting. Well, thanks for that, David. Now, I do want to move on to, in a similar sort of area, I suppose you could say, but I was speaking to a couple of people in the green room, and I was explaining to them that I was going to have a quick chat with you about the moon and Apollo 11. And The great thing I like about you, David, is we can talk about anything and everything within the boundaries, of course, of it being sensible. And I like the fact that you're willing to answer most questions, and you normally have an answer for anything. So talking of answers for everything, I do want to quickly talk about colonization, because that's something that people talk about and you often see it in the movies. But is life potentially possible on the moon, or could we potentially use it for something other than maybe it just being there in the sky and helping to control the waves?
It is possible to build a moon base. Discoveries made in the last 20 years make it a little easier. There are plans to build bases at the lunar poles, which is a very interesting region. It's a region of long shadows where the sun hardly moves above the horizon. It stays on the horizon. And throughout the year, the sun goes around the horizon and the shadows move around like the arms of a clock. But that's an important region because not only is the sun visible for most of the time, so you can get energy from the sun, solar energy. You can't do that from the equator where there are 2 weeks of night and 2 weeks of day. But also we think there's ice in the lunar dust. And that's important because, you know, when you dig it up and melt the ice, you've got air to breathe, water to drink, hydrogen and oxygen can be rocket fuel, and you've got stuff to grow plants with. So you'd have to take a lot with you to colonize the moon. But the more we learn, the more we're understanding how you have to live there. Like the ice would give you water, and advances nowadays with 3D printing means that we might even be able to send up a precursor unmanned flight. And this 3D printing robot could actually start building the habitat, building the houses. By the time we get there, it's already mostly done, and the water's already in the taps.
I mean, that's just incredible, isn't it? Because 50 years ago, you just wouldn't think that anything, or I say you wouldn't think, you would actually be told you was just dreaming and living in unicorn land for even thinking of that. But, you know, it's amazing, isn't it, that 50 years on, because we've discovered so much, that is now a possibility. Now, David, I do want to summarise here on Apollo 11, because I know you've written a book on Apollo 11, and as I said at the beginning of the interview, it's available, I would imagine, online. Apollo 11, The Inside Story. Now, what can we look forward to in that book? What is it? I'm interested in knowing from you, because you're such an expert on this topic. What is in there? What would be a real treat for the everyday layperson like myself who doesn't really know much about the moon and Apollo 11?
I tried to write a book that was different, because most of the other books I've read about Apollo are they took off at this time and they went into this orbit, and then they went to the moon, and then they landed at this time, and, oh, that's, you know, technical details too much.
Yeah.
So what I did was I wanted to write it. I knew this is an exciting story, so I wrote it rather like a film in the sense that I took, for the mass part of the book at least, extracts from a lot of interviews I've done over the years, and I picked out the best bits, and I wasn't shy of using quite long extracts because I felt that telling the story with the people involved, the astronauts, the administrators, the politicians, the Russians, everybody who was involved with it, stringing together their comments to tell the story of the mission, made it, I thought, a very exciting and pacey and thrilling read, because I wanted to bring out the drama of when things went wrong and things went badly and the tension of the first landing on the moon. And I think if you concentrate on people's emotions and what they say and what they remember, it makes for, a more popular, a more satisfying read than knowing about orbits and diagrams of landing and how much the fuel tanks held. So I'm very pleased I did it that way. And I'm thrilled to bits that it's had some great reviews. Writers always love it when people say nice things about the book, and I've got nothing to complain about. I'm proud of the book, and I'm so delighted that other people like it.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, I think a lot of people would agree with you on that. On that indeed, because I'm certainly someone who wishes to purchase the book and actually have a peruse through it, because that's one of the things I like about what you're explaining here and what I gathered from the book before actually buying it, and that was that it does go through the finer details without boring you, without wanting to, you know, insult other people that discuss Apollo 11 and discuss the moon. It does it in such a way.
There's no worse thing than a boring book, Billy.
Indeed, indeed. Well, thanks for that, David. And I do want to ask you one last question, and then I'll let you go, because I know you're obviously quite busy. And it's just regarding when we will go to the moon again. Will there ever be? Because I'm pretty sure the first moon landing so far has been the last moon landing. So is there going to be another one, potentially? Will we ever go back as space enthusiasts, as people that are interested in the moon? Will there ever be a chance for astronauts to go back? Because that's what I'm also curious about.
Well, Apollo was the first. There were 6 lunar landings and 12 people walked upon the moon, and only 4 of them are still alive.
Interesting.
Get back to the moon before there are no moonwalkers amongst us.
Yes.
NASA has plans to get back by 2024, but the problem is that since the moonwalks, lots of people have had lots of plans, and they've started out on plans and projects. But sooner or later in America, somebody wants the money and takes the money away from the project, and the project dies. So we really need a project that's sustained and funded well. And it remains to be seen if the last effort, this current effort, is going to do that. I hope so. It's about time we had people back on the moon.
Indeed, indeed. Well, thank you very much for that, David. Thanks very much for your time this afternoon. It's been absolutely great speaking to you. We are now going to go into another track, and that's going to take us into the break. Great to have Dr. David Whitehouse on the line. He is, of course, an author and, of course, a seasoned broadcaster as well, as you can probably tell. Absolutely knowledgeable and an expert on quite a lot of things. So very good to have your company this afternoon. At 16 minutes to 5, we are now going to play The Blue Mink, and this is Melting Pot here on Vectis Radio.